and a profoundly moving privilege to welcome you most warmly to Rhodes House for this lecture in memory of an exceptional Rhodes scholar, Bram Fischer, to be delivered by his friend and colleague, Advocate George Bezos, SC. A lecture in memory of one of the great lawyer heroes of the struggle against apartheid, to be given by another of the great lawyer heroes of that historic struggle for justice. We hope that the memorial brochure on your seat, which gives details of the lives of Bram Fischer and of George Bezos, will be of interest to you and a memento of this special occasion. The names of George Bezos and Bram Fischer are, of course, unbreakably linked with each other and with that of Nelson Mandela, whose photographic portrait, taken in this building on one of his several visits here, Mr. Mandela's portrait adorns this hall. And we are in turn unbreakably linked with him through the Mandela Rhodes Foundation, which supports African students undertaking postgraduate study in South Africa. In his autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom, Nelson Mandela wrote of his years as a law student at the University of the Witwatersrand. Quote, "At Wits, I met many people who were to share with me the ups and downs of the liberation struggle, and without whom I would have accomplished little." After mentioning Joe Slovo and Ruth First, Mr. Mandela wrote, I quote, "I began lifelong friendships with George Bezos and Bram Fischer. George, the child of Greek immigrants, was a man who combined a sympathetic nature with an incisive mind. Bram Fischer, a part-time lecturer, was the scion of a distinguished Afrikaner family. His grandfather had been Prime Minister of the Orange River Colony, and his father was Judge President of the Orange Free State. Although he could have been Prime Minister of South Africa, he became one of the bravest and staunchest friends of the freedom struggle that I have ever known." Unquote. Bram Fischer and George Bezos were, of course, to serve together in defending Nelson Mandela and others in the treason trial of 1956 to 61, and again when Mr. Mandela and others faced the real possibility, indeed the likelihood, of the death sentence in the Rivonia trial of 1963-64. Mr. Mandela later wrote, quote, "Perhaps it is George's tactical skills in matters of the law for which he is best known. It was this skill that led Bram Fischer, the leader of our defence team in the Rivonia trial, to include George in that landmark event. Indeed, it was George Bezos who warned us at our first consultation after the Rivonia arrests that the government was preparing the ground for the death penalty to be imposed on all of those arrested." Unquote. Not long after the Rivonia trial, George was to serve in the legal team that defended Bram Fischer himself when he was, in turn, on trial. It is fitting tonight also to mark the various contributions to these legal struggles of Joel Joffe, Lord Joffe, who is here tonight and who, as Nick has mentioned, has helped magnificently to organise this lecture and to whom we are extremely grateful. It's fitting to remember the contribution of Sir Sidney Kentridge and also of the Rhodes Scholar Rex Welsh, who for many years organised the Rhodes Scholarships in South Africa. His two successors in that role, Justices Laurie Ackerman and Edwin Cameron, have both also been Rhodes Scholar lawyers, active in the fight against apartheid and in continuing efforts for human rights. And Justice Cameron will deliver next year's Bram Fischer Lecture here at Rhodes House next January. In late 1965, when Bram Fischer was on trial, an organising secretary from the Christian Action Defence and Aid Fund in London wrote to the Warden of Rhodes House, Sir Edgar Williams, seeking information about Bram Fischer's Oxford career for use in their materials to raise money for his defence. Sir Edgar Williams replied, "Thank you for your letter about my friend, Mr. Abram Fisher. He read first of all jurisprudence and got a third class degree in 1933. He then took a third year to read for the Diploma of Economics, which he passed in 1934. He played rugby football and lawn tennis for New College, and he was president of the Rawley Club, a Commonwealth society which, the warden wrote, still meets as it did in his day in the bite room of Rhodes House on Sunday evenings." It was in the bite room of Rhodes House, next to the bust of Alfred Beit, that Nelson Mandela, in fact, was photographed in this portrait. Sir Edgar Williams' predecessor as warden of Rhodes House, Sir Carlton Allen, who was warden when Bram Fisher was in Oxford from Hillary term 1932 until the summer of 1934, also clearly regarded Bram Fisher as a friend. Warden Allen's admiration for him was clear in his annual scholar reports. At the end of Bram Fisher's first year, Warden Allen wrote, "A most attractive man who shows not only qualities of great common sense, but of self-sacrificing kindness to others." At the end of his second year, Warden Allen wrote, "In numerous ways, he has derived great benefit from his time in England, and in character, outlook, and disposition, he is one of the most attractive Rhodes scholars we have. I am certain that he will be a man of mark and always of the most admirable personality." And when Bram Fisher left Oxford in 1934, Warden Allen wrote, "One of the most delightful of the Rhodes scholars from any country, and a man who has won universal esteem and affection." After previous university training, he did not come to Oxford primarily for academic experience, and he has certainly derived the fullest and most judicious advantage from it in all other ways. All who have been in touch with him view his departure with real regret. This high estimation of Bram Fisher was shared by the warden of New College, H.A.L. Fisher, no relation, who was also a Rhodes trustee, and who wrote admiringly of Bram Fisher's charm, character, and ability. In Trinity term 1933, Warden Fisher wrote, "One of the nicest and most generally respected men in college, should exercise an admirable influence in the Free State." That Michaelmas term, the Warden of New College wrote that Bram Fisher has gained greatly in width of outlook from Oxford, and in the summer of 1934, simply, "one of the best men in college." In May 1948, just before the National Party came to power in South Africa, Bram Fisher in Johannesburg completed a form for Rhodes House giving an update on his activities, the first form since before the war. He wrote, "1. Married 1937 to Miss S.J. Molly Cricker. 2. Three children. 3. In active practice in Johannesburg as a member of the Transvaal Bar. 4. Principal activity, underlined. Politics as a member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of South Africa." He enclosed this form with a letter to the warden in which he wrote, "During the war, the medical members of our army frustrated me at every turn, and I failed to get past them either by argument or deceit. And so, as my form discloses, I turned to politics instead. No doubt, my activity in this direction will come as somewhat of a shock to you and Mrs. Allen. Nevertheless, it may be of interest, as I doubt whether there is any other Rhodes scholar yet who is on the Central Committee of a Communist Party." He was wrong. In fact, the warden, who had no sympathy for communism, replied, quote, "You are by no means the first Rhodes scholar to have espoused the communist cause. There are several quite prominently connected with it in Australia." And indeed, there was one such Rhodes scholar who was elected as a communist for a seat in Queensland in the late 1940s. Bram Fischer's letter had continued. I quote, this is in May 1948. The setup in this country, of course, seems to lead one inevitably to socialism. With its race hatreds, prejudices, oppression, and endemic fascism, South Africa forces one to the conclusion that mere palliative measures will never succeed. In my lifetime, I have seen the vote taken away from two large sections of the community, the Indians in Natal and the natives in the Cape. Thus, I took the plunge, one of the results being that I now appear in the police files as a man with a record. A number of us were convicted under our Riotous Assemblies Act of assisting in the illegal strike of African mine workers in 1946. It's all somewhat Gilbertian, of course, he wrote. I still continue to be briefed by mining houses and other capitalists, and my wife, who called on you in Oxford in 1937, continues to remain on good terms with her family, that is, her uncle, General Smuts. Bram Fischer concluded his letter to the warden of Rhodes House, I would love to see you and Oxford again. At present, there are no prospects, especially as our youngest is only 9 months old. However, we are determined to make a trip, and so someday we shall turn up at Rhodes House, and I shall be able to thank you and Mrs. Allen again for all you did for me. Today at Rhodes House, we think with gratitude of all that Bram Fischer, at immense self-sacrifice, did for the rights of others. In remembering Bram Fischer's role in the struggle for human rights and a genuine and just rule of law in South Africa, we are immensely privileged to have George Bizos with us. When Bram Fischer first entered this hall at Rhodes House nearly 80 years ago, George Bizos was a very small boy in Greece. When, I didn't give away your secret, George, when Bram Fischer tried to enlist to fight the Nazis in World War II, George's family perilously escaped the Nazi onslaught and ended up as refugees in South Africa. And then in the study and practice of law in South Africa, the lives of George Bizos, Bram Fischer, Nelson Mandela, and others struggling for freedom interlocked. And George became not only Mr. Mandela's lawyer, serving him and his family on innumerable occasions over half a century and more, but also a legal colleague of and then a lawyer for Bram Fischer. Nadine Gordimer, who in the 1960s had written about why Bram Fischer chose jail, wrote this of George in the 1990s. The gales of war blew a 13-year-old Greek boy to our shores. He was to become a South African civil rights lawyer of international standing, a devastating cross-examiner of apartheid's authorised torturers and killers. Long before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was visualised, George Bizos pursued the truth of what was being done to those who suffered under and had the courage to oppose a racist regime turned brutal tyrant. When George Bizos won a case, it was not just a professional victory. It was an imperative of a man whose deep humanity directs his life. That deep humanity is reflected in George's memoirs, fittingly entitled Odyssey to Freedom, which I commend to you. And I am sure that it will be evident in his Bram Fischer Memorial Lecture and in his response to your questions afterwards. In his powerful and moving forward to Odyssey to Freedom, Nelson Mandela writes of George as his close friend, a wholly trusted confidant, through prison years and presidency and beyond, who is considered a member of our family, Uncle George, to three generations of Mandelas. And, I quote again, a man whose contribution towards entrenching the human rights that lie at the heart of South Africa's constitutional values is impossible to overrate. Ladies and gentlemen, Advocate George Bezos, SC.
In due course, I will thank the people who invited me here. I look around and I see Lord Joel Joffe, and Aneta, whose mother made burra biscuit for the accused in the Rivonia trial. Burra biscuit is a very special rusk, and a large tin was made and pick it up every Sunday evening. When we consulted their apartment before going to the trial in the morning, I want to say a word or two about the South African High Commissioner, Zola Sikwea. He was in exile. He came back to South Africa in the early 90s. We worked together at CODESA. He was the leader of one of the negotiating teams, and he appointed me his legal advisor. Zola, thank you for being here. It's been an emotional meeting. I haven't seen you for some time. And I remember the difficult times that we had during the process. The struggle in South Africa was a struggle for human rights for all. One of the champions of that struggle was Bram Fischer, QC, who was a devout believer in the rule of law, in the independence of the judiciary, and a social democratic state. Bram died in prison about 50 years before the advent of democracy in South Africa in 1994. Nelson Mandela delivered the first Legal Resources Center's Bram Fischer Lecture in Johannesburg in 1995. He, that is Mr. Mandela, said that as he stood at the voting booth next to him were the late Bram Fischer, Oliver Tambo, Chris Hani, and Chivalbert Rutuli. Bram did not see the promised land, for which he dedicated both his private and professional life. Nelson Mandela in that lecture said the following: Bram was a courageous man who followed the most difficult course any person could choose to follow. He challenged his own people because he felt what they were doing was morally wrong. As an Afrikaner whose conscience forced him to reject his own heritage and be ostracized by his own people, he showed a level of courage and sacrifice that was in a class by itself. I fought only against injustice, not against my own people. When terminally ill, the apartheid regime released, in inverted commas, him in the custody of his brother Paul, but declared his brother's home a prison to prevent Bram's relatives, comrades, colleagues, and friends from visiting him. Only four of us from the Johannesburg bar, and there were hundreds at that bar at the time, led by Izzy Maisels, QC, doyen of the bar, went to Bloemfontein to his memorial service. The funeral oration was to be delivered by André Brink, a young prominent Afrikaner writer who had regularly attended Brahms' trial to the annoyance of the security police, who due to unforeseen circumstances was unable to do so. Arthur Chaskelson, later Chief Justice, delivered the funeral oration. At the airport, we saw Chief Justice Frans Roemf, who had been appointed ahead of others because of his loyalty to the regime. He asked us what we were doing in the judicial capital of South Africa whilst his court was in recess. When we told him that we had come to Bram Fischer's memorial, he surprised us by saying, "He will be remembered long after all of us will be forgotten." His prophecy was fulfilled. There are main roads, a township in Soweto, and two buildings in the center of Johannesburg, mainly occupied by lawyers' names. Books have been written, films have been made, and memorial lectures have been delivered on his life and work. President Nelson Mandela, four Chief Justices, Ismail Mohammed, Arthur Chaskelson, Pius Langer, Margaret H. Marshall of the Massachusetts, and the Deputy Chief Justice Pius, Chief Justice Dihang Moseneke, have delivered the Legal Resources Center and Bram Fischer Lectures. Lord Joel Joffe and the Constitutional Court Justice Albie Sachs have delivered lectures in Brahms' name at New College, Oxford, his alma mater. His school, Gray College in Bloemfontein, and the University of the Witwatersrand, Wits, and other institutions have honored him. As a junior colleague of Brahm, who was a family friend and my mentor, who chose me to be a part of the team to represent Nelson Mandela and others at the Rivonia trial, and who chose me, led by Sidney Kentridge, you see, to defend him, I appreciate the opportunity to deliver this lecture in his honor. I thank Lord Joel Joffe, Professor Nick Cheeseman, Warden Don Markwell, New College, Rhodes House, Oxford University, and others who made it possible for me to speak to you this evening. I have chosen to speak about the man, his beliefs, and the high price he paid for pursuing his ideals. Excuse me. Brahm was a patrician, Afrikaner stock, whose grandfather and father had played important roles in the history of South Africa. Before he chose to identify himself with the oppressed, it was widely believed that he would one day be either the Prime Minister or Chief Justice of South Africa. He enjoyed great respect amongst his colleagues. He put it to good use. His request to leading members of the bar to make themselves available for those charged with political offenses or who had espoused unpopular causes were hardly ever refused. In the first Legal Resources Center Bram Fischer lecture, President Nelson Mandela said, "With that background, he could not but have become an Afrikaner nationalist, as we became African nationalists 30 years later as a result of our oppression by whites. Both of us changed. Both of us rejected the notion that our political rights were to be determined by the color of our skins. We embraced each other as comrades, as brothers, to fight for freedom for all in South Africa, to put an end to racism and exploitation. I was beneficiary of Brahms' assistance. I was refused South African citizenship because of my radical behavior as a student at Wits. My lack of South African citizenship posed a problem in relation to my admission to the bar, putting into question my right to practice law in South Africa. I discussed the matter and my problem with Joe Slovo, who was born in Lithuania and had also been refused South African citizenship. He made no secret of the fact that he was a devout communist. He was advised me that he was admitted because Lithuania was no more. I asked Joe if he could move my application, and he replied, and I quote, "George, for a Lithuanian Jew and a communist at that, to submit that there is nothing wrong for a Greek to take an oath of allegiance to Her Majesty the Queen would be a submission not likely to be accepted." He suggested it would be better if a more senior barrister, preferably an Anglo-Saxon, was asked to do it. You see, race background played an important part in the administration of justice in South Africa. Joe told me that Brahm had arranged with Rex Welsh, then a prominent senior junior at the bar, to move my application. Rex Welsh was not a stranger to this university, as you have heard. Because Welsh was not available on the day of the application, he arranged for H.C. Nicholas to do it. Nicholas was delighted when he saw on the court roll that judges Lucas Steyn and Franz Rumpf were to hear the matter. He said that these judges had to take an oath to the British Crown when they were admitted. Because they were Afrikaner nationalists, they probably crossed their fingers when doing so. He was proved right. It was not necessary for him to argue the matter. Judge Steyn asked if I was in court and said I must come forward to take the oath. And that was the end of the matter. Shortly after my admission, I was briefed with Brahm Jr. on a matter concerning the expropriation of land owned by an Indian family, contrary to the provisions of the Grievance Act. I received my first lesson on the use of legal language, which, according to Brahm, has no room for adjectives and adverbs. On June 26, 1995, at the Congress of the People in Cape Town, the Freedom Charter was adopted by thousands of multiracial delegates. It declared that South Africa belonged to all who live in it, black and white. Professor Z.K. Matthews, an African devout Methodist Christian, originally proposed that such a document should be adopted to set out many of the human rights enunciated in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The propagandists of the regime called the Freedom Charter a communist document inspired by the Communist Party, which had been declared an unlawful organization in 1950. 156 of the leaders of the African National Congress, the Indian Congress of Natal and Transvaal, the Congress of the Colored People, the Congress of Democrats, the last of which was alleged to be a front for the Communist Party, were arrested in December 1956 on a charge of treason. Brahm persuaded half a dozen of the leaders of the bar to appear at the preparatory examination of the accused at the army headquarters in Johannesburg. It had been converted into a courtroom in which a large cage had been constructed to accommodate the accused. The legal representatives threatened to withdraw and that the accused would not take part in the proceedings if the cage was not removed. It was removed overnight. All the accused were committed to trial, even though Vernon Berenger exposed serious weaknesses in the state's case. Brahm played an important role in that trial, which lasted for almost 4 years. He arranged for a number of other members of the bar to appear for the accused. They included Easy Mazels, Vernon Berenger, Rex Welsh, H.C. Nicholas, Sidney Kentridge, Chris Blumen, and an outstanding solicitor, Michael Parkington. Amongst the accused were Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, Duma Nokwe, Helen Joseph, Joe Slovo, and others. Some of us at the bar who were not briefed to appear assisted the team, particularly in unearthing provisions in various countries with democratic constitutional provisions similar to those contained in the Freedom Charter. The defense of the accused was that the Freedom Charter was a blueprint for a democratic South Africa and not a communist dictatorship, as alleged by the state. The accused were separated into groups, and only 32 were involved in what had become known as the first of a number of trials. They were eventually acquitted in June 1961, a Pyrrhic victory, because the ANC was declared an unlawful organization after the Sharpeville massacre in March 1960, in which 69 people died and hundreds were wounded. On December 16, 1961, the manifesto of Umkhonto weSizwe, translated as a spear of the nation, was published, and acts of sabotage were committed against symbols of apartheid. In its manifesto, it declared, "Umkhonto weSizwe fully supports the national liberation movement, and our members jointly and individually place themselves over the political guidance of that movement." The purpose of the carefully drawn statement was to protect the tens of thousands of members of the ANC and other organizations from being vicariously liable for the acts of MK. It later became known that Brahm played an important role in the formulation of the manifesto in order, among other reasons, to persuade Chief Albert Luthuli and other nonviolent supporters of the liberation movement that MK would be kept as a separate organization. It did not help. The government promulgated a proclamation to the effect that the one included the other. For those of you that may not know, that Chief Albert Luthuli had received, shortly before the public announcement of MK, the Nobel Prize for Peace. The manifesto further states, "The time comes in the life of any nation where there remain the only two choices, submit or fight. That time has now come to South Africa. We shall not submit, and we have no choice but to hit back by all means within our power in defense of our people, our future, and our freedom. The government policy of force, repression, and violence will no longer be met with by non-violent resistance only. The choice is not ours. It has been made by the nationalist government, which has rejected every peaceable demand by the people for rights and freedom and answered every such demand with force and yet more force. We of Mkhonto weSizwe have always sought, as the liberation movement has sought, to achieve liberation without bloodshed and civil clash. We do so still. We hope, even at this late hour, that our first actions will awaken everyone to a realization of the disastrous situation to which the nationalist policy is leading. It was also made clear that the violence would be against symbols of apartheid, with special care being taken that there should be no loss of life. The regime welcomed the development. Excuse me. Thank you. It was made the regime welcomed the development. Its apologists cried from the rooftops that they were right in saying that the ANC was a violent revolutionary organization. It had now showed its true colors. They said that they were right in branding it as a terrorist organization, not different from the Italian Red Brigades of Italy, the Bader-Meinhof gang of Germany, and the PLO of Palestine. Laws were enacted to equate sabotage with treason and provide for the imposition of the death sentence. They to introduce detention with trial for 90 days, later increased to 180 days, and finally for an indefinite period. Detainees were tortured to reveal those involved in MK or further in the objects of the unlawful ANC and the Communist Party. Some were chosen to give evidence against their relatives, friends, comrades, and co-conspirators. Failure to give evidence led to imprisonment for a number of years. Numbers in the security forces were increased. On July the 11th, 1963, a thunderbolt struck Lilith's farm, located in the outer suburbs of Johannesburg, with the leadership of the ANC. Walter Sisulu, Govan Mbeki, Ahmed Kathrada, Remon Shaba, Dennis Goldberg, Rusty Bernstein, and Bob Heppel were arrested. Photographs in chaplainess disguises were published. The statement released by the security police hailed it as a major breakthrough in the elimination of subversive organizations. After him, they also announced that they had discovered many incriminating documents, among them Nelson Mandela's diary, containing entries which proved that he was the leader of MK. He had undergone military training and canvassed support in the newly independent African states and other European and African countries, Asian countries. Hilda Bernstein, the wife of Rusty, turned to Brahm to arrange legal representation, not only for her husband, but also for all the others. Joel Joffe, a former member of the bar and thereafter a solicitor, and now a member of the House of Lords, had temporarily taken over the practice of James Cantor. Cantor was arrested as an act of revenge for his brother-in-law, Harold Walpe, who was involved but escaped from custody. Brahm approached Joffe to postpone his emigration to Australia to represent what became known as the Rivonia accused, who at the time were in incommunicado detention for a period of 90 days. Joel and Arthur Chaskinson, later Chief Justice of South Africa, were close friends. Arthur was in Brahm's group of advocates. Arthur volunteered to join the team. Brahm wrote to Vernon Berenger, who had played a very important role in the treason trial and other important political trials, but was out of the country. He also asked me to join the team. We could not see our clients. We did not know what they were going to be charged with. But we inferred from the numerous statements made by the security police, the Minister of Justice, John Foster, and Prime Minister Hendrik Frensch Verwoerd, who was known as the Apostle of Apartheid, that those arrested in Rivardia and some of their accomplices would not only be convicted, but sentenced to death. The sub judice rule was ignored. Joel, Arthur, and I assumed that the leader of the team would be Brown. He informed us that he could not be without explaining why not. Arthur Jackson said that no one else at the bar could tell the judge and the world at large that the people in the dock did nothing different than what the Afrikaners did, and more particularly what General C.R. de Wet, the hero of the Boer forces during the Anglo-Boer War, had done in 1914. He led a rebel force against the government that entered World War I. He was sentenced to a short period of imprisonment, even though a few hundred people had died in the rebellion. We eventually persuaded Brown to lead the defense team. None of us at that time knew that he was involved as the leader of the Communist Party in the underground struggle. It later became clear that the security police, the prosecutor, and the government knew of Brahm's involvement. They deliberately chose not to make it public, except on a couple of occasions when tidbits of evidence were led which suggested that it was so. Their probable motive may have been that if it became known that a leading Afrikaner played an active part in the liberation movement, their branding of it as a terrorist organization would not be readily accepted. On their release from incommunicado detention to become awaiting trial prisoners, we were surprised that Nelson Mandela was among the accused. He had been serving a term of imprisonment for leaving South Africa unlawfully. He came to the consultation room in prisoner's attire. The other accused, who had not seen him for more than a year, were delighted to be united with him. The warders were surprised by the collegiality amongst the accused and their lawyers. An indictment was served, which was carefully scrutinized by Brahm and Arthur. It named the National High Command as accused number one. Brahm and Arthur drew a request for further particulars to the indictment. The state response was slovenly. It was decided to take an exception against the indictment on the grounds that it was vague and embarrassing. The trial became known as the Rivonia trial and later as the trial of the century. It attracted the attention of the world at large. In early October 1963, before sunrise, Brahm drove down our driveway in his noisy Volkswagen. He was in an excited state of mind. He handed me three copies of the Rand Daily Mail newspaper with a banner headline that the United Nations had resolved to call for the end of the Rivonia trial. Brahm knew that I was going to visit the accused in Pretoria later that morning. As he was handing me over the newspapers, he exclaimed, "Take these with you and tell them that they dare not hang them now." The exception to the indictment succeeded. The indictment was quashed. Brahm's argument in his usual quiet and in incisive manner was accepted. Persecutor and overzealous prosecutor appealed to the judge, De Wet, not to quash the indictment. He was so excited, he actually, for a man doctorate in law, didn't spoke about not squashing the indictment. And the indictment that he would comply, and that he would comply with any order made by the court as to how an indictment should be rectified and what particulars should be given. The judge curtly said, "It is not the function of the court to guide the prosecution as to how to draw an indictment." Judge De Wet didn't like Dr. Persecutor. During the course of argument, Brown drew attention to the prosecutor's answer that the accused knew what the particulars were, and they didn't have to be told what the particulars of the crime that they were charged with. In the judgment, the court said that the answer presupposed that the accused were guilty, an unusual and impermissible allegation. Quashing the indictment did not prevent the security police from rearresting the accused, which they did immediately after the judge left the courtroom. Some of the media within and outside South Africa, not concerned with legal niceties, called for the release of the accused. Letters, telegrams, telexes came from governments, and particularly from the non-aligned movement, trade unions, freedom-loving organizations advocating the implementation of the doctrine of universal human rights and calling for the release of the accused and all political prisoners in South Africa. Despite these calls, the prosecution served a new indictment. Brown was appearing before the Privy Council in London, and Vernon Berger had not yet returned to South Africa. The trial commenced in their absence. Joel, Arthur, and I appeared for the accused. The prosecution led a number of witnesses who were mainly Africans who had worked at Lilly's Leaf Farm and had been detained under the detention laws for 90 days. They gave evidence that Nelson Mandela had lived on the farm before his arrest, along with some of the other accused, and that some of them met at the farm from time to time. We were instructed not to challenge their evidence, except Rusty Bernstein's denial that he had not put up the radio transmitter to which Walter Sisulu addressed the nation shortly before their arrest. We confined our questions as to whether the witnesses had been given any reasons for being detained and held in solitary confinement, or whether or not they asked to be released. The prosecutor was offended by our questions and blurted out that they were not in detention, but in protective custody, term not known to our jurisprudence. He must have felt that the media would want some explanation. His embarrassment did not end there. Thomas Mashafani, the senior worker at the farm, at the end of his evidence, asked the judge for permission to speak. He asked, "Did the police have the right to assault him if he had done no wrong?" This question became headline news. The judge asked the prosecutor to investigate the allegation. On the next day, the prosecutor assured the judge that he personally had fully investigated the matter. He was satisfied that it was not true, and added, Thomas, did not want the matter to be taken any further. We were not given any opportunity to consult Mr. Mashafani. Before the beginning of the trial, it was agreed by the accused and Brown, as our leader, that the crux of our defense would not be to put in issue what they and their organization had done. Instead, as a general strategy, they would become the accusers. They gave effect to it. When asked by the clerk of the court, "Accused number one, Nelson Mandela, how do you plead to the indictment served upon you?" "The government should be in the dock, not me. I plead not guilty." "Accused number two, Walter Sisulu, how do you plead?" "It is the government that is guilty, not me." The others followed suit, despite the judge's injunction that they should confine their answers to guilty or not guilty. Only James Canto, who was not involved, followed the practice by saying, "I am not guilty." Brown believed that Nelson Mandela, as the leader of the movement, should make a statement from the dock. He felt it should cover what the liberation movement stood for, how hard it tried to achieve its objectives by peaceful means, and to deny the scurrilous allegation that it was a terrorist organization under the influence of the communists and the Soviet Union. These were allegations that found favor by many, particularly those in the West, who divided the world according to East and West during the height of the Cold War. The defendant's case commenced with Nelson's statement from the dock. He stated, "The ideological creed of the ANC is and has always been the creed of African nationalism. It is true that there has often been close cooperation between the ANC and the Communist Party, but cooperation is merely proof of a common goal, in this case the removal of white supremacy, and it is not proof of a complete community of interest. During my lifetime, I have dedicated myself to the struggle of the African people. I have fought against white domination, and I have fought against black domination. I have cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an ideal which I hope to live for and achieve, but if needs be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die." Brown knew Walter Sisulu well. He was confident that Walter would be an excellent witness, would withstand the cross-examination of the prosecutor. Despite his lack of formal education, Walter was considered to be the wise man of the liberation movement. He was thoughtful, articulate, with a deep-seated belief in the rightness of the movement's cause. Joel and I were seconded to recognize Walter on the issues and produce a full statement from which Brown was to lead him when he entered the witness box. Brown guided us as to what the issues that Walter would deal with. I often drove Brown from Johannesburg to Pretoria, either to consult or attend court. Not everyone in the team, particularly Joel Joffe, was in favor of Walter giving evidence under oath. He feared that Walter would not do well under cross-examination and that no useful purpose would be served. The counter-argument that the insistence of Walter himself prevailed. Walter would emphatically deny the operation of Mayabuya had been adopted to engage in guerrilla warfare, as it was contrary to the non-violent policy of the movement. This document was found on the table at the time of arrest. He did so during his evidence. Brown patiently and meticulously conducted the final consultations with Walter. He and Vernon recognized Walter on the issues he was likely to be questioned by the prosecutor. The answers given during consultations persuaded all of us that Walter would win the day. He certainly did, particularly when the prosecutor suggested that the ANC did not represent the African people and their grievances put forward. That there was no evidence suggesting that Africans desired the vote. Well, how he came to that conclusion, he never explained. Walter had ready answers. He only lost his temper once when speaking about his son's arrest and detention outside the courthouse for failing to have a pass, which was not even required at his stage. Walter said to Utah, "I wish you could be a black man for only one day in your life, and then you would stop talking about alleged grievances." Then on a lighter note, when it was put to him that he and others were pawns of white communists, he snapped back, "Has it occurred to you that the white communists may be our pawns?" So keen was Utah to advance the regime's propaganda throughout his cross-examination that he failed to cross-examine Walter on his emphatic denials that Operation Buya had not been adopted, an elementary omission not worthy of his seniority and experience. Brom was a communist who believed that there should be an egalitarian democratic society. He rejected the document Operation Buya, which he felt was unduly influenced by the apparent success of the Cuban Revolution, as envisaged by Che Guevara and his intellectual French guru, Jules Régis de Debray. Brom and Walter Sisulu described the document as an adolescent aberration. The Cold War from the late 1940s to the early 1960s expected Western countries and their citizens to reject any form of socialism. Two Americans, Thomas Carris and Gwendolyn Carter, who were in South Africa to assess apartheid policies, came to court to observe the Lavinia trial. Gwendolyn Carter was intrigued by Brom, but she, being a good American, could not understand how such a good man could be a communist. I suggested to her that the time when Brom joined, there was no other political party or group that advocated political rights and equality for the African people. Somehow or other, this came to Brom's ears. The following morning, on our drive to court in Pretoria, Brom said to me, "George, do not ever apologize to anyone for my political beliefs." There were members of the bar who could not understand why he should be a communist. He refused to discuss his political beliefs, particularly because the Communist Party was an unlawful organization from 1950. This did not, however, prevent his colleagues at the bar from voting for him as a member of the Bar Council on no less than 10 times, and even as its chairman in 1961. The revelation of Stalin's oppression of the people of the Soviet Union was a matter of great concern to him, as was the foreign policy of Khrushchev, particularly in relation to Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and other Eastern European countries. Those outside the struggle for freedom apparently did not understand the pact of those involved in it, that your political, religious, and personal views were not as important as the solidarity of all concerned with the primary objective of defeating apartheid. Thus, the alliance of religious leaders such as Chief Rutuli, and I have a number of other names for those who are interested in detail. I will not read them out, but let me assure you that they were as mixed a lot as that you would ever find, from highly religious people of different faiths, Protestants, Catholics, people like Bishop Tutu and others. There was one thing. Are you for the struggle or against it? And in the words of Oliver Tambo, when he was asked, a devout Christian himself, leading the struggle outside, how he could cooperate with communists, he said, quote, "If you're drowning and somebody throws you a rope, you don't stop to ask his political beliefs." Uppermost in our minds, both lawyers and accused, was the probability that a death sentence would be passed. Brahm raised the question as to who we should approach to give evidence in mitigation. He approached a number of prominent persons, most of whom declined. A few tried to soften the blow of their refusal by saying that should we be prepared to sign a petition for clemency if and when the death sentence was passed. Others maintained that they did not know the accused personally. Alan Paton, the head of the Liberal Party and celebrated author of Cry the Beloved Country, when asked by Graham, agreed to do so even before the inevitable conviction of most of the accused was decided. Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, Governor Mbeki, and others were convicted. And Alan Paton was to be the evidence in mitigation. I was deputed to consult with Alan Paton, and the consultations took place at the home of the British Consulate General Leslie Minford. I wrote out a statement of what Alan Paton agreed to say. He spoke about the struggle of the African people to acquire political rights, and Mandela, Sisulu, and Mbeki's deep devotion to the cause of their people. When speaking about the use of violence by the movement, he referred to the Afrikaners' use of violence to fight the British. This did not please the judge. For reasons not clear to us, Brahm insisted that a plea in mitigation should be presented by Harold Hanson, then a doyen of the Johannesburg Bar, whom Brahm considered a great and fearless advocate. Nelson Mandela had written out the night before what points he would make if asked what he wanted to say before the sentence of death was to be passed on him. I think it was Joel Joffe that actually retrieved the scribbled note. And one of them was difficult to read, but somebody did manage to decipher it. Statement from the dog. "I meant everything I said. The blood of many patriots in the country has been shed for demanding treatment in conformity with civilized standards. The army is beginning to grow. If I must die, let me declare for all to know that I will beat my fate like a man." He didn't have to use the notes. The convicted accused were sentenced to life in prison. After the conviction and sentence of the eight leaders, the accidental death of Brahms' wife, Molly Krieger, was a devastating event for Brahms. Brahms was the driver of the vehicle and blamed himself. In September 1964, Brahms and 13 others were arrested for contravening the suppression of communism. He was admitted to bail by the magistrate despite the state's opposition. The fact that he was a leading member of the bar, that he had recently been granted a passport to enable him to argue a case before the Privy Council, and his unequivocal undertaking to return to stand trial were held to be sufficient to grant him bail. The magistrate described him as a son of the South African soil. True to form, Brahms did come back. Evidence was led particularly by the informer, Gerald Ludi, who had infiltrated the Communist Party, and also Piet Bielefeld, an Afrikaner leading member of the Communist Party. Brahms was confident that the letter would never give evidence against him and his co-accused. He was wrong. Bielefeld later explained his actions by saying, "I wanted to be released from the 90-day detention. My liberty became very important to me. I can think of nothing but my liberty, and I am prepared to forsake my lifelong principles for it. I have no other principle but to obtain my own liberty." By the end of 1964, after the long adjournment of the trial, Brahms was wrestling with himself as to what he should do. Whilst he was still in London, the leaders of the movement in exile urged him to eschew his bail and go into exile from where he may continue the struggle. He rejected the suggestion. I was not involved in that first trial. We nevertheless discussed it. I inferred that Brahms was thinking of extricating his bail from his questions in relation to the morality of disobeying unjust laws. We discussed Prometheus's defense that he had stolen fire from the gods for the benefit of mankind. Antigone's violation of the decree that no one was to bury her brother. Solon's fragment as to what honor was to be given to the Tyrannoctonus, the killer of the tyrant. Mahatma Gandhi's defiance of colonial laws. The 1914 Boer Rebellion. And Nelson Mandela's defiance of unjust laws as early as 1950s. In whose case the court held that there was no moral turpitude in his participating in the defiance. On the Friday before the Monday on which he was to appear in court, he came to my chambers. Fearing that my office may be bugged, he beckoned me to the passage. He told me that he could come to say goodbye. He feared that members of his family, particularly his daughter Elsa, may be detained or face difficulties with the authorities. He requested I should do whatever I could to assist. We embraced and said nothing more. Knowing that I was being watched, I feared that I was not to communicate with him. On Monday morning, Brahms' counsel, Harold Hampson, appeared in court and read out a letter written by Brahms in which he said, "I can no longer serve justice in the way I have attempted to do during the past 30 years. I can do it only in the way I have now chosen." John Foster, the Minister of Justice, was highly critical of the Johannesburg Bar's criticism of the apartheid regime for its abrogation of the rule of law, and particularly the introduction of detention without trial, and its appointment of political supporters as judges. He challenged the Johannesburg Bar to show its respect for the rule of law by dealing with the lawlessness of one of its senior members, with some of us described in indecent haste. The Bar Council resolved to apply to court to have Brahms struck off the roll of advocates soon after he went underground. Sidney Kentridge and Arthur Chaskelson appeared to oppose the application. The judges, De Wet, Hill, and Boshoff, heard the application. Brahms' counsel relied on a number of cases in support of the submission that political offenses did not lead to the striking of the offenders from the legal profession. The court distinguished these cases. Judge De Wet, who had presided at the Rivonia trial, said, "It is clear that the respondent, that is, Brahms Fischer, made full use of his status as a senior counsel in inducing the magistrate to grant him bail, and his breach of this solemn assurance can clearly be stigmatized as a dishonest conduct. If the respondent were to apply for readmission at some future time, similar considerations may apply. It is impossible for this court to foresee what will happen in the future. We are concerned with laws in force at the present time and with the structure of society as it exists in this country at the present time." The authors of a chapter in a book on the history of the Johannesburg Bar, Marcus S.C. and J.K. Kentridge, wrote, "The application was unjust because it was motivated by political considerations, but because it left out of account the moral and political considerations which took Fischer's conduct out of the realm." Sorry, this is a duplicate page. Yes, dishonorable and self-serving deception, and made it instead a supreme moral sacrifice. I recall a senior security police officer seated on a bench outside the courthouse that was about to enter, aggressively asking me, "Where is your friend Brahm, George?" I responded, foolishly perhaps, "He is Mr. Fischer to you, and he is in my backyard." Fortunately, he had some sense of humor, and our home was not searched. By the time of his rearrest, apparently 10 months later, his co-accused in the suppression of communism trial had been convicted and sentenced. The prosecution converted that trial into a preparatory examination, which further evidence of Brahms' underground activities was led. He was charged with other offenses, including sabotage. I represented Brahm at preparatory examination in the magistrate's court. We decided that we should not at that stage challenge any of the evidence that was there. The prosecution produced an album of photographs, mainly of the people who had been detained after his second arrest. This investigating officer handed me a copy. I paged through it and saw my own photograph. I waited until midday adjournment of the court and showed it to Brahm. He was furious. He suggested I should draw the magistrate's attention and complain. I persuaded him that we should not do that. There was no better way of showing our contempt for the security police and the prosecution than when we ignored them when they behaved outside the rules. They probably hoped that some witness might identify me, find me as having been in contact with Brom. Bartholomew Chopani, who had been a member of the Communist Party since 1962, gave the most devastating evidence. He was able to give evidence of its workings. He cracked under interrogation when detained. What upset Brom most was that he did not confine himself to the truth. The effect of what he said was that the Communist Party was in control of both the ANC and the MK, and that Brom himself was a supporter of unbridled violence. Chopani also falsely said that the Christian Institute and the director Beres Nadir, the Defense and Aid Fund, and the Institute of Race Relations were involved in the communist conspiracy. He repeated what Bruno Mtolo had said in the Rivania trial. Brom shook his head in disbelief that the person that he considered a loyal comrade has succumbed to lying under oath. As expected, Brom was committed for trial. He chose Sidney Kentridge to lead me, and his trial to be held in Pretoria in the beginning of 1966. Brom was transferred from the Johannesburg Fort Prison, where the Constitutional Court is now located, to the Pretoria local prison. It looked onto a courtyard we had been told by Brom that Yopi Fourie, an Afrikaner nationalist military officer in the South African Army who refused to participate in an attack on German Southwest Africa, had been executed in 1914. Brom was in that yard, struggling to dry himself with a towel none bigger than two handkerchiefs after a cold shower. I turned my head away. I thought that the practice of inviting judges from other divisions to deal with the matters where other judges or leading lawyers were involved would be followed. Brom told me that it would not happen, and there would be a volunteer from our own division. He named W.G. Boshoff. He was right, but would not tell me why he thought so. The prosecution team, led by J.H. Liebenberg, assisted by a man very proud of his name, of Klaus von Lieres und Wilkau, proud of his aristocratic German origins, followed Jutta's example, not only being satisfied with the conviction, but also to discredit Brom. When Brom's chambers were searched on his arrest, a draft copy of the program of the South African Communist Party entitled The Road to South Africa's Freedom was found. The printed copy was put in as Exhibit 39 at his trial. The prosecution did not draw attention to the, I won't read them out, to the sections of this document, which was obviously drawn by Brom, that they did not intend winning a violent struggle. The controlled violence was for the purposes of bringing the government to the negotiating table. the last paragraph, the possibility we would be open to a peaceful and negotiated transfer of power to the representatives of the oppressed majority of the people. That did in fact take place in 1994. We decided that Brahm would follow Nelson Mandela's lead by pleading not guilty and making a statement from the dock. He would not deny that he had committed many of the acts set out in the indictment, but would explain the reasons why he had chosen to lead the underground struggle. Brahm stated, "I'm on trial, my lord, for my political beliefs and the conduct of those beliefs drove me to. My lord, when a man is on trial for his political beliefs and actions, two courses are open to him. He can either confess to his transgressions and plead for mercy, or he can justify his beliefs and explain why he has acted as he did. Were I to ask forgiveness today, I would betray my cause. That cause, my lord, is not open to me. I believe that what I did was right. My lord, there's another reason, and a more compelling reason for my plea. I accept, my lord, the general rule that for the protection of society, law should be obeyed. But when the laws themselves become immoral and require the citizen to take part in the organized system of oppression, then I believe that a higher duty arises. My conscience, my lord, does not permit me to afford these laws such recognition as even a plea of guilty would involve. Hence, though I shall be convicted by the court, I cannot plead guilty. I believe that the future may well say that I acted correctly." He was convicted and sentenced to life imprisonment. Apartheid ruled supreme. There were separate jails for white and black political prisoners. Blacks were on a Robben Island and whites were in a specially constructed annex to Pretoria prison, electronically controlled. Some whites, like Brahm, were singled out to receive demeaning treatment reserved for traitors. The Afrikaners' warders' behavior was spiteful. In some respects, the condition of whites was worse than blacks on Robben Island. Leading members of the bar, such as Easy Maisel, Sidney Kentridge, and others, were refused permission to visit Brahm. The warder in charge tried to prevent his visiting judge from having a private conversation with him. Two of his fellow prisoners, Hugh Lewin and Dennis Goldberg, have written books describing the prison conditions and the impact on Brahm specifically. They describe the conditions as the most brutal there would ever be, particularly for Brahm. He was not allowed to attend his son's funeral nor his daughter's wedding. The medical care provided was less than accurate. It was more than inadequate. Brahm's terminal cancer was misdiagnosed and not properly treated. Shortly after he was transferred to his brother's home in Bloemfontein, he died. His body was not handed to his family. He was cremated. His ashes were not given to his family. The family believed that they were lied to when much later the authorities said that the ashes were kept in a safe place. After the democratic elections in 1994, the family and a number of Brahm's friends wanted his name as advocate to be restored on the roll. There was doubt as to whether a deceased person's name could be restored. Brahm was not the only lawyer disbarred for political reasons. Representations were made to the newly appointed Minister of Justice, Dalla Omar, for the passing of an act of Parliament authorizing the courts to restore the names of lawyers who were removed from the role of advocates for political reasons. Eventually, the necessary legislation was enacted. We approached Judge President Gwepi of the Transvaal Provincial Division to appoint a full bench of 3 judges to hear an application on behalf of Brahm's daughters, Ruth and Elsa. He readily responded that he would preside at such an application and that he would appoint 2 other judges to constitute a court, the composition of which would have pleased Brahm. He, being an African, asked a white Afrikaner woman, there were no women judges in Brahm's time, Judge Snedders, who wrote the judgment for the court, and an Indian male, Judge Bonan. Judge Snedders wrote, "The application of our Brahm Fisher's removal was heard by a full bench of this division. It was in our view, therefore, appropriate that the application for this reinstatement should also be heard before a full bench. But even more appropriately, before the court was representative of the diversity of our society as possible. This is the sort of society that Brahm Fisher fought for. The future time to which reference is made in the judgment for the striking off has now arrived. The Society of Advocates recognizes that Mr. Fisher was a fit and proper person to continue to practice as an advocate. Mr. Epstein, supported by Mr. van der Linde on behalf of the General Council of the Bar of South Africa, submitted that a grave injustice was done to our Brahm Fisher. It fell to this court to rectify that injustice. In the result, and for the reasons stated, it took little urging from Mr. Bezos on behalf of the applicants to persuade us to grant an order we made on the 16th of October 2003 for the reinstatement of our Brahm Fisher's name on the roll of advocates. Much of what Brahm Fisher lived, fought, and died for has been achieved in South Africa. The South African Constitution and the South African Constitutional Court protection of human rights would have pleased him. And yet he would have been disappointed that poverty, inequality, criminality, corruption, lack of proper education, inadequate health care, lack of housing, and land distribution are still with us. South Africa is not yet the egalitarian society that he believed in. He often said, "Nobody has ever been condemned for having tried but failed." He was a pragmatist who believed that injustices over a period of 3.5 centuries could not be remedied within a few decades. Some of his contemporaries may have considered him a failure. Even if most of them now accept that he was not. He was one of the main pillars upon which a bloody revolution was avoided. He was a senior partner of Nelson Mandela in their efforts to avoid a bloody civil war. This is how he is and will continue to be remembered. Thank you for listening.